There are a few things that come around every year, just like clockwork. Some are a lot of fun, like your birthdays and the holidays. And then there are some that aren't always so pleasant, like tax day. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Tax day is a little over a month away, so it's coming down to crunch time. And I'm lucky and really grateful to have Dale Kunin with us. Dale is a certified public accountant. She's a certified information technology professional. She holds an MS in accounting science from UW-Madison, over 20 years experience as an accounting professional, working in public accounting, in private industry, in government, education, so lots of experience. And she's a partner with Wegner CPAs in Madison. She shared her expertise with us several times already, and lucky for us, she's here again. Dale, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for that wonderful introduction. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you back. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. If you have a question or comment, you can reach us by phone at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there, and we would certainly love to hear from you. And let's talk about dependents for a minute. Huh? You'd think you'd know who your dependents are, but...
Well, dependents, I actually had a call from a client today who's in the same boat as a lot of other people. They have, 20-something living back at home, college graduate.
Yeah.
And they wanted to know if the kids could be dependents. And the answer was, unfortunately for them, no, because they graduated from school and they were working, not in what they hoped to be working in and not in the field that they wanted to. But they make more than $3,800. And so if you have an adult child who's living with you who earns more than $3,800, they can't be your dependent. So that's not a whole lot of money, as we all know.
No. And so the age doesn't really make a difference.
Well, there's a series of tests to see if somebody can be your dependent. And the first way they can be your dependent is if they're a qualifying child. And a qualifying child is either someone who lives with you and is under 19 years old, and they can have a job, most likely their kids in school.
Yep.
And if they're in college or they're in a full-time, if they're a full-time student during the year for at least 5 months of the year, they can be your dependent no matter how much they earn, as long as you support them, if they're under 24. So you can claim a dependent who's, in college, and even one who graduated, like in May, that's 5 months. They were student for part of 5 months, but then you hope they go and get a job and earn more than $3,800.
Yeah.
They can't be your dependent. And then the other way that somebody can be your dependent is they don't have to be your child. They have to live with you the whole year, but again, they have to have gross income that's less than $3,800. So, and the benefit of being a dependent is you get the exemption, the personal exemption for that person. But there are also some other benefits to have a dependent: education deductions or credits, the child credit that is just off the deduction of how much tax you owe, the dependent care benefits, and there are separate rules for how you determine, for example, in a case of separated parents, who gets to be their dependent.
And I suppose if grandma's living with you, not very good shape physically, you're still caring for her, obviously, maybe you're doing all the care, but she's getting Social Security.
She can't be your dependent.
Can't be the dependent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's I can remember that from my own family experiences. So I didn't want to bring that up. We have Bonnie in Little Chute with a question for you. So we'll go to her. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I find myself in the need to apply for an extension on my taxes. I was wondering how I go about doing that.
Well, you can, if you prepare the return yourself, you can submit a paper form to the IRS, and the Wisconsin will honor that. And if you are have a tax preparer, or I'm actually not familiar, but I believe that they're, if you're electronically filing through TurboTax or one of those, you may be able to electronically file for an extension. We do our extensions in our firm. We do them electronically. That way we get an acknowledgement that it was accepted. And a reminder that if you have to extend, if you have to apply for an extension for the time of when you have to file the return, it's not an extension of the time when you have to pay your taxes. So you have to do you have to figure out how much you're going to owe and pay that essentially with the extension, or you will be subject to some interest and penalties. So again, it's an extension of the time to file, but not of the time to pay.
Okay, so I can do that right online through Turbo.
I don't know. I'm not familiar with the TurboTax. And I can't answer that question. You may be able to do it online through TurboTax.
All right. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Thanks, Bonnie. Marilyn in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. I've got a question on these class action suits that attorneys set up as a class action, and then you get a money like, you know, $2-3 checks, and
yeah,
and some of them I don't even know recognize what it's for. It was slow access to internet, and another one was for something else. What do you do with that?
Well, depending on what the class action suit was about, technically you need to report all of your income. So the fact that it was $2 or $3, it sounds like a nuisance. The technically correct would be to put that on line 21 of your tax return as other income that you received. So, again, it's unusual to be the recipient of multiple payments from a class action suit. So that's a question I haven't had much.
But IRS doesn't get a 1099 on those.
If a payer does not send a 1099 to you, then they haven't sent one to the IRS.
Right, and if it's under a certain amount, they don't have to. Am I correct?
They don't have to file. They don't have to file a 1099, but that doesn't mean that you don't have to report the income.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for your help.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling, Marilyn. Appreciate it. And Michelle in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about college tuition. This is the first time in our tax filing that we have paid tuition. And from the various forms and information I've read, there's a lot of credits and deductions that are out there, but I'm noticing that almost all of them, if not all of them, and that's what I wanted to confirm, have maximum adjusted gross income levels.
This is true. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
So the more income that you make, the less likely it is that you would qualify to take. There's a credit. There's there's a refundable credit and a non-refundable credit. The difference being, with a refundable credit, even if you don't owe taxes, you get that money back. That's American Opportunity Credit. But it is limited to adjusted gross income limits, and there's a tuition deduction that is also limited,
Are all of the opportunities to try and deduct or itemize or whatever your tuition, do all of them have ceilings?
Yes.
Okay. I've been hunting to see if there's
No. Sorry, Michelle.
All right. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Yes. Judy in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Judy.
I have a question about, is there a carryover of the deduction costs for long-term care insurance that exceed the federal limit in any given year?
No. The deduction for long-term care insurance, the federal deduction, is combined with other medical expenses to go into the itemized deductions. And if it is excluded because you haven't... because you're over the AGI, the adjusted gross income, it's that deduction's gone for the year.
That's not what I mean.
Oh.
When you deduct for long-term care insurance, in Wisconsin there is no limit. Whatever you pay, you can deduct.
Right.
But in federal, it depends on your age, and the maximum for the age group that I'm in is $3,350, but I paid more than that. I legitimately paid more than that, but I could only take off the $3,350.
And that is the... That's your only shot at that deduction for the year.
I can't carry it over to another year.
No.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Mary emailed us and said, my husband's only source of income last year was unemployment compensation while I continued to work. What guidelines would help us decide how to file, you know, whether separate or joint? We always filed jointly before when both of us worked.
That's a very good question, because I don't know if Mary's in Wisconsin. Assume she's in Wisconsin. Wisconsin is a community property state, a marital property state. So filing separately does not mean that you can file his income on his return and your income on your return. You're required... in absence of a separate marital property agreement, to take your total income and expenses and divide them in half, and then each of you report that 50%. And it's very rare that that is a more advantageous way to file than to file jointly. So I doubt very much that you would get any benefit from filing separately, because it's really taking 100% of your income and splitting it equally in half.
There we go. What we have here next is an email from Gerard in Milwaukee. Can you explain or expand the definition of for a distant relative dependent parent you financially support but does not live in your home and lives on a fixed Social Security income? So would that person... Could you have a dependent, you financially support this dependent, but the dependent does not live in your home and lives on a fixed Social Security income?
So that person who's your parent, can qualify, but the income test is applied. And if it's a qualifying relative, then it doesn't matter if he's related to you, that they can live somewhere else. They don't have to live with you. But again, that gross income test is applied.
At $3,800.
For 2012, yes.
There you go. Laurel in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you. My question is, what is the qualification for disabled?
If you have a qualifying child or qualifying relative, if they're permanently and totally disabled, then they can be your dependent, regardless of what kind of income they have. But they have to be totally and permanently disabled.
This is the federal form where it says, are you over 65? Oh, yeah, well, we are. Are you disabled? And, this is for my wife, and she cannot walk by herself. She has a handicapped sticker, but does that qualify her?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, because you're getting the exemption because she's your wife, and the only kind of additional personal exemption is if somebody is legally blind. That's the way the tax code works, and they must have had a better lobby than the orthopedics. I don't know.
Oh, there you go. Sorry, Laurel. Appreciate your call, though. Dale Cunin, certified public accountant and certified information technology professional, partner with Wegner CPAs in Madison, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson back with us. Great to have her back on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest Dale Cunin. She is a partner with Wegner CPAs in Madison, talking about taxes today with her. Certainly you can join in at 800-642-1234. Go to my Facebook page. You can post there at the Larry Mueller Show. Nadine in Brooklyn, your turn. Hi.
Hi. I'm one of these people that didn't take out my minimum distribution once I reached 70 and a half within that first year, whenever it is the deadline is. And my understanding is that I'm now going to be penalized at like 50%.
Well, there is that penalty. So the rule is that you have to take your first required minimum distribution in the year after you turn 70 and a half.
Right.
So in that year, there would be actually two distributions you would take if you hadn't taken the one when you were 70 and a half. You take two that year, the one from when you were 70 and a half. If you fail to make a distribution, you can, if there's some reasonable cause for why you made that or why you didn't make it, you can write a letter to the IRS and ask to have the penalty abated. And the best way to do that is to, you know, throw yourselves on the mercy by saying, you know, you didn't do it deliberately, and that tell them what plan you have to going forward, not miss one. And the IRS can be very forgiving about that particular penalty, especially that first year.
Oh, okay. Good.
And I'm wondering, when we're, somebody else asked this question who has like three different ones, can you take it all out of, your minimum distribution? Can it be taken out of just one? And
yes, to calculate the required minimum distribution, you take the sum of all of the IRAs, and then it doesn't matter where it comes from.
Oh, okay.
As long as it's from
They had a friend who had
IRA.
One that was smaller than the other two and just wanted to take it all out of the one.
Yeah, there's no, as long as they're all, IRAs, traditional IRAs, you don't have any non-deductible IRAs mixed up in those accounts, then yes, you can treat it as if it was one, and it doesn't matter where the funds come out of.
All right.
And do I just write the IRS? I mean, how do I contact the person to plead my case?
You would write a letter to the IRS at the address that you
pay your taxes.
That you send in your taxes, and you would include your Social Security number on that letter, so they have a reference to apply it to, and just state your case. And again, for a reasonable cause, so you know, be creative. And and they generally, you do have to file the form that in your tax return that shows that you didn't make that payment, but you don't necessarily have to pay the penalty with the form. And don't send the letter with your return, because they won't read it.
Right. So in other words, I probably am not going to get this resolved before April 15th. So I deal with this separately, and then
yes,
they end up crediting my balance later?
Yes. If they accept your plea, they would remove the penalty.
Yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And I can envision scenarios where, let's say, it's the surviving grandma or grandpa and is not incapacitated somehow, and the children not even knowing.
Yes, it's the rules are complicated and not everybody knows them. The trustee that holds your IRA is supposed to notify you that you have a required minimum distribution, and they may tell you what it is or not, but they're supposed to inform you about
uh-huh.
it. So, and not everybody gets the message or understands, and so again, it's not that uncommon that
yeah.
somebody misses it, especially that first year. As long as you show good faith effort to rectify the situation, because you do have to take that payment out. I mean,
yeah.
you may have missed it, but you need to take it out. She needs to say that she did take it out. And generally, I've seen those payments, those penalties abated.
Dave in Deerfield, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hello. I have a question. I went about electronic return. I went to a service that helps people do their tax returns at the Madison Public Library, and this was on the 23rd of February, and I have a refund coming from the state of Wisconsin. I was tracking it, and they said there's no record yet. On your history, how long does it take before you should at least get an acknowledgement that the state has, I've done this a couple years, about 3 years in a row now, and I can't remember how long it takes to get the acknowledgement, at least, that I was.
So that was filed, it was filed electronically for
correct.
You on
right.
the 23rd?
On the 23rd, correct.
So,
And I have a refund coming, and I was just anxious, and I looked up the place to look up your refund, put in my Social Security number, the mm-hmm. 2012 tax year, and the amount of the refund, and it says there's no history of your I don't know if somehow did not get electronically sent to them. I haven't called the state yet. I just your program was on, and I just thought I'd ask you how long it takes.
Well, you should get an acknowledgement
instantly
that it was within a day yeah. that it was received.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I thought. So I'm kind of
so so you probably need to go back to the folks that actually submitted it.
Yeah,
and
okay.
see if they have if they got the acknowledgement, if they have
yeah.
a record.
Okay.
There were some delays in forms that could be filed. So I don't know the circumstances or what forms you might have had, but
right.
some of the forms weren't even accepted by the IRS until like the 1st of March. Some other ones just last week. So
it's
possible, but you should check with them, because once a return is electronically filed, the originator of that return gets an acknowledgement within a day. I mean, it can be instantaneous, but it...
Okay. Typically, it's within just 24 hours or so
yes.
of
the filing. That's what I thought it was the other years. Okay, I guess I better follow something more to follow up on. Thank you very much.
Okay,
for
good luck.
Yeah, good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Lee in Brookfield emailed us and says, I have some 1099 payments I received for freelance writing. Some of the writing was for travel articles. I paid for the travel on my own, then wrote and sold the articles, earning far less than the cost of the travel. What expense can I deduct? So, you got a situation here where it sounds like...
You can deduct the the reasonable expenses for earning that money. Now, I don't know the circumstances, the specifics of the travel that that you did, because if you took a trip, for example, and you were gone for a week and you wrote one article, the test is supposed to be what portion of that trip was for pleasure and what was for business. If there was an element of pleasure, personal use in that, then you can't deduct the whole thing. So, you know, we asked clients, did you have any fun on that trip? And, you know, be careful what you answer. But in truth, just if you traveled to Italy and you wrote a review and you toured around and you know, had a tourist experience, the entire trip is not deductible.
Jean in Mercer. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I received an inheritance this year, and my husband and I have always filed jointly, and I'm wondering if that's going to make a difference in our taxes, if we should do something that we don't normally do.
Well, what did you inherit in terms
was
of...
Was it dollars or was it...
Yeah, money.
So inheritance... itself is the cash that you receive is not subject to income tax. If you inherited an IRA, there are rules for taking the IRA out over time, and those are subject to income tax. If you inherited securities that earn income, then the income that's earned on those inherited securities are taxable. But life insurance proceeds and receiving the cash from
bank account,
a distribution is not of itself taxable for income. That would be.
So I need to find out what kind of investments my parents had, because I don't know at this point.
Right.
When and if there may be an estate that needs to be probated, or maybe there was a trust that was created and. And so the estate becomes an entity, and as a beneficiary, if there's any income in that estate and you take a distribution, then you get taxed on that. But that involves a tax return that has to be prepared for that estate.
Okay.
Got it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jean, for calling. Don in West Salem. Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
Our current accountant, or tax preparer, whatever, told us that we couldn't declare our mortgage interest on our taxes, and we've done that way for several years. But my wife was talking to a friend whose husband's also an accountant, whatever, and they said that we could have declared mortgage interest rate on our taxes. Is there any reason why?
What is the mortgage on? What kind of property does this mortgage secure?
Is it your home?
Yes.
Your home?
Yes.
So you need to inquire of the tax preparer what it is that is the circumstance that is not making it deductible. The mortgage interest on your principal residence is deductible, but if you don't have enough itemized deductions to exceed the standard deduction, then you just take the standard deduction and all of those itemized deductions like the mortgage interest and the real estate taxes and charitable contributions are not a benefit to you. So I'm not sure what the specifics are, but it may be that the standard deduction is appropriate for you, and that's why the mortgage interest wasn't being deducted.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. And it'd be pretty easy for you to figure that out. What's the standard deduction now for a couple?
For this year, the standard deduction, again, it depends if you're over 65 or you're blind, as the as the first one said. So, for a single person, the standard deduction is $59.50, and there's some other deductions if you have a different filing status.
No.
So
married is
twice that $59.50. So
almost $1,100. I'm sorry, $11,000. So about $11,000, Don.
If 65.
If if you're under 65, it's roughly $11,000. You can add up what you donated to whatever organizations, church or whatever, and nonprofits, and then add your
real estate
taxes together. And if they add up to less than that, that's probably,
and your state taxes that you pay.
And state taxes, yeah.
Okay.
So that. That could well be where the problem
is. It may be that that's what I suspect, but you should directly ask the preparer what this is.
You definitely should ask. And sometimes, too, older, you know, maybe you've got the house paid for, and so you're not able to deduct your interest because you don't have any.
Or the interest is minimal compared to the principal payment.
Yeah. Carla in La Crosse, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi. Hello. My question is, I am paid hourly wage and compensated for mileage. That all comes together on my W-2. Is there any way to separate that out? That's apparently considered income.
So the mileage that you get reimbursed for
from my job,
business travel is included in box one of your
right.
If it's reimbursed by the employer and you have you provide substantiation, you supply some documentation that shows that you did in fact have those miles, it should not be included in box one. And so you can talk to the employer about that. The only way to deduct those miles from your income is through miscellaneous itemized deductions, which have a 2% ceiling. So you have to get over that amount. And then you also have to have enough other itemized deductions to get to that point. So mileage that is reimbursed by the employer for reasonable business travel is not subject to income tax.
Okay, because I've been filing it like that, you know, ever since I've had this job. So I'll have.
Well, how do you, are you certain that it's included in that box one, or is it just included as information on your W-2?
I have to look at it. I don't have it with me right now, but I will look at it and make sure it's not on there.
Yeah.
Saying it could be listed on another section on my W-2.
Yes, it could be an informational listing in box 14, or I would be very surprised if it's included in box 1.
Okay, I will look at that and see what it says. Thank you.
Yep, thanks, Carla. And Stuart in Germantown. Hi, thanks for waiting.
No problem. All right, my question is, I am now required to take out IRA distributions, and I have several that I have to take out before April 15th, I believe. But my question is I also had one account that was a combination life insurance policy and an IRA account. We never claimed it as a IRA deduction, but the policy came due last year, and we transferred the money from there into a bond fund that is growing. And I want to make sure that I don't get stuck for a large penalty on that.
So was it some sort of annuity that you had invested in? Is that what it was?
No, it was a combination life insurance policy and IRA. It was a 30-year policy.
Well, it sounds to me like it's some sort of annuity plan, and so in those circumstances, the when you take a distribution from that, the preparer of the trustee that holds those funds would prepare a 1099 R, and it would have the your contribution listed on it, so it would you can deduct from each of the distributions the amount that you didn't that you contributed, your basis in it, and so you'd essentially only be taxed on the growth if there is growth on that. So I'm not really familiar with
It was a Metropolitan policy, and it came due, and it was either I take the lump sum, or and I rolled it over or transferred it into a bond thing.
Well, it sounds like it may have been a whole life policy or an annuity.
It was.
It was a whole life. Then
it
you're...
has nothing to do with an IRA.
No.
But all the years that I got the paperwork on it, it was noted as the life insurance, but also IRA. Now, my accountant, all these years, we never claimed it. I just don't. I just want to make sure that what should I do to make sure that I, at a later date, find out that they, I owe them half of the money on that life insurance policy.
Well, when you say you never claimed it, you mean you never took a deduction for an IRA, and that's appropriate. That you made an investment into this this policy, and you only will be taxed on the difference between what you invested and what you get back.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Dale Kunin, our guest today, certified public accountant, excuse me, and a partner with Wegner CPAs in Madison, talking taxes with her. You might have a question. If you do, call us, 1-800-642-1234. That's the number, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest Dale Kunin, a certified public accountant with Wegner CPAs in Madison. Great to have her along. Thanks for listening in. And tell you what, we had a comment about an earlier question from someone who, a guy who had, hadn't received his paperwork about the filing of his taxes. And here's Tyler says to the caller asking about the confirmation of receiving his paperwork, I had my refund in my bank account before I had confirmation that paperwork was received and being processed. So there you go. And for our earlier caller, you might want to even just check your, go online, check your bank account. It's possible the money's already in there.
It's probably not if the system that he went on, the where's my refund, doesn't have. But I suspect that there's some glitch in the electronic filing. But
I think you're right.
When you do electronic filing and ask for electronic deposit of your refund, It's very, very quick.
Here's an email from Sharon. If one spouse is under 70 and a half years old, can the minimum distribution from the older spouse be put in the IRA of the younger spouse? And if so, can the payment come from joint checking account?
No, you can't add to an IRA. The only way to add to an IRA is by the allowable IRA deductions for earned income. You have to have earned income to be able to add to an IRA. The only other way is if you have, for example, an IRA and you want to convert it to a Roth IRA, but you can only add to an IRA when you have a deductible IRA when you have earned income to do that. So no, you have to take the required minimum distribution out of your the 70 and a half spouse, and then you can put it in your checking account or your savings account or invest it in securities if you don't need it for living expenses, but you can't put it into your spouse's IRA.
Paul in Iron River, hello there.
Good morning. Say, I have a question that may be based on naivete, but I came in a little bit after the program started, and I don't know if this question is or a similar question has been posed yet, but this pertains to my situation. I am retired. I've been retired for 3 years now. My income annually comes on into a bit less than $25,000. My income pertains to Social Security, an annuity from the agency that I retired from, and also from a couple of minor CDs. However, last year in 2012, from the savings that I personally had saved, I paid off the homestead. So no longer do I hold a mortgage. However, my betrothed decided to head for higher ground, and we are separated, not in a legal sense, but just in a a mutually agreeable sense. We parted as friends. We are not enemies at all, and she always, in our relationship, always did the taxes, always in an admirable manner. And however, this time it's different, and it's different because not that there's a lack of trust of mine regarding her, but it is this question about the paid-off mortgage, and I'm wondering, how do I deal with that? And also, I've heard that if a person in my age, I'm over 65, if you have a total income of $25,000 a year, that is also hopefully subject to somewhat diminished tax payment. I have paid in taxes every year since I retired. Last year, even though I made less than $25,000, I paid darn close to $1,000 in taxes, state and federal both. What? Hopefully, you can shed a little bit of information here, especially pertaining to the mortgage situation. Well,
the mortgage shouldn't. I'm trying to figure out what issue the mortgage would be, Dale.
I don't know either.
Yeah, well, let's see what Dale's got to say.
So you aren't divorced, is that correct? You're separated but not divorced?
Yes, ma'am, that's it.
And do you both live in Wisconsin?
Yes, ma'am.
And do you have a marital property agreement or a separation agreement?
No, okay. No, not yet, because
we're
both friends.
So you are eligible to file a joint return.
Mm-hmm.
Your only other option is to file married filing separately.
Mm-hmm.
And as I mentioned earlier in the show, in Wisconsin, in order to do that, you have to combine your incomes,
mm-hmm,
and split them in half.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to take your expenses, combine them, and then split them equally in half.
Uh-huh.
So it's probably simpler if you prepare a joint return.
Yeah.
That's what I'd recommend.
Okay.
As far as paying off the mortgage interest is the only part of your that's eligible for deduction. So paying off the principal is not a taxable event.
I see. Okay.
And so whether you have enough other itemized deductions to...
No, we have never itemized, ma'am.
Then the mortgage is not relevant, and I suggest you just file a joint return and... combine your income, because it would be more complicated to combine it and then separate it.
Okay, that I've discussed this a couple of times with my former, and she has said fundamentally the same thing. But I was thinking, wait a second, am I cutting my own throat by disclosing to her just exactly what the mortgage payoff was, et cetera, et cetera?
No, shouldn't make a difference. Couldn't imagine it didn't make a difference. Thank you very much for calling. You know, if there was eventually a divorce, you'd on the property, there'd have to be some evaluation of the value of the property anyway. So it wouldn't make a lot of difference there, Paul. Appreciate your call. I want to give Nicholas in Fort Lee, Virginia, chance.
Correct. I am an active duty military, and I was deployed from December 2011 till October 2012. I never filed my taxes for that year. My question is, can I file both 2011 and 2012 taxes and this year?
Yes, but you need to file them separately, not combine them. So you need to file your 2011 on a 2011 form and
okay.
only include your 2011 income and expenses, and then do the same thing with 2012. And if you if there's no taxes due, there will be no penalty for filing that late. But we do recommend that you file a return so you can get it in, start the clock for the 3 years that they could go back and look. So you should get that filed, but you can't combine it.
Right.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And Gary in Montello. Hello.
Hello there. How you doing?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Hey, you're welcome. Hey, I have a question. I work for a trade union. And as part of our pay packet, we get a base wage and then, of course, other payments from the employer, which includes anything from annuity to helping out new employees to health care, which we have our own health care, but it's paid in, you know, approximately $4 an hour is what it amounts to. Is any of that deductible?
So the employer or the trade union pays the health insurance, or you...
Well, it's on our wage. We get a base wage, right, which we get paid an hour, let's say $31.25 an hour. And then on top of that, the employer is required to pay us for all the annuity and health care and everything else, which comes out in hourly fashion. Health care, I think right now, is $3.82 an hour they pay us so that we can purchase our insurance.
And do you purchase the insurance from a plan that the trade union has, or do you go and shop?
Correct. It's a plan that the trade union has.
So depending on whether, and I don't know if they do, but it's likely that the trade union has what's called a premium-only plan, which means that those that the portion that is paid, that the employee that you pay in is not subject to the income taxes. So if those amounts are included in your box one, your taxable wages, then there's an opportunity to claim that as part of those total itemized deductions, which it's very difficult to get the total of medical expenses.
Well, we get at the end of the year from the insurance company, we get what's called a work assessment rate, and it tells us exactly how many hours we had to pay, or the companies had to pay where we work for, pay us,
mm-hmm.
for the insurance. So it tells exactly how much, because we really only need to put in like 117 hours a month to cover our insurance, and then the rest is just extra money that we pay in and kind of goes to a health service account. Where if I, at the end of the month, they'll send me a notice, and then I need it back or whatever. They'll let me send that receipt in, and they'll pay me for it.
So
it's pretty complicated.
It sounds like it's a cafeteria plan where they're letting you, they're reimbursing you for some expenses. And so the only place that you can deduct that on the federal return, if it is subject to income tax, is on the Schedule A as part of the medical total medical itemized deductions. And if those don't total more than the 7.5% of your of your gross income, then it, you can't even, you won't even see it on the return. There is a deduction on the Wisconsin return for a part of that if you are employed and your employer doesn't pay your health insurance. But if they pay part of it, then you're not going to.
And thanks, Gary, for calling. Dale Kunin, our guest CPA with Wagner CPAs in Madison here on the Ideas Network. She'll be with us right up until 12:30. If the thought that tax day about a month away raises your blood pressure, I can guarantee that you're not alone. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for spending time with us today on the Ideas Network. Chances are you have some questions about how to file your taxes correctly and what has changed from previous years, and we're happy to have CPA and tax specialist Dale Kunin with us for the next half hour. She has lots of great advice and tips, and happy to answer your questions when you call or when you email or when you go to my Facebook page. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us. That address is talk@wpr.org. Hope you'll go to my Facebook page. That's at The Larry Mueller Show. Go there and click like while you're there. We'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics and actually a whole lot more. We'll be back with Dale Kunin right after this look at the news. Stay with us. They say that in this world, nothing is certain except death and taxes. But one big difference is that tax day comes around every year. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Tax day about a month away. Time to really crank it up and pay your, some attention to getting your tax returns put together. Dale Kunin, certified public accountant, certified information technology professional, our guest. She holds an MS in accounting science from the UW-Madison, over 20 years of experience as an accounting professional. So it's great to have. She works with, she's actually a partner with Wagner CPAs in Madison. Dale, thanks again for spending time with us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We have many callers online. I'm going to go to Larry, who's been waiting a long time in Springbrook. Larry, thank you for calling.
Hi. I've got a question regarding filing status, and that my wife passed away this past August. She was 70 years old, and I'm 63 years old. And as far as income goes, it's not much income. We're kind of, you know, always been living on the edge. But I'm not sure on the status if I can still file jointly and what kind of deductions are would I still be able to have.
Well, I'm sorry for your loss. You are eligible to file jointly in the year that your wife died. So if she died in August, then for 2012, your filing status is still married filing joint. And that is a more advantageous filing status than single, which in 2013 you would need to file. So your filing status is the same. It's a joint return, and you her name goes on the return and indicate that she is deceased.
Mm-hmm. And
okay,
that allows you an extra about $6,000 for.
Well, you get it. You get her personal exemption, which is $3,800, and depending on your standard deduction, if you have instead of if you don't itemize, then your standard deduction, you get the $11,900, and all of anything that has a income test. You qualify for the married filing, a married couple for this year.
Okay. Yeah, I've been using TurboTax, and we go through the whole deduction process that they take you through, and it always ends up at the end that the standard deduction is more advantageous.
Yeah.
And so the standard deduction for married filing jointly is twice as much as the deduction for filing single. So this year you file the same way that you have been.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't too sure. It's always one of the once a year issues.
Understood.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks, Larry. Scott in Norwalk. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Over the past 20 or so years, I've been self-employed, and I've always had a deduction, I'm not sure the exact amount, of my health insurance. And so this past year, I was able to become a domestic partner for my health insurance. My partner, she works for the state, so it's a state plan. She pays an added amount because of this from, you know, deducted from her paycheck. My question being, is there still a deduction available to me being self-employed, or is there a deduction that she is able to use, you know, and which would be the best if we have something?
If you're getting your health insurance through an employer, as a domestic partner, then you don't qualify for the self-employed health insurance deduction. And depending on the accounting, there may be it may be a taxable item that for the amount that is being paid for your health insurance on the state. I don't know if your partner pays 100% or if the state is contributing something towards it, but they're if you're getting if this, I didn't mean the state. I don't recall if you said you were that you worked for the state or
yeah.
Okay,
she works for the state.
Okay, so the amount that's being deducted that she's paying in, if that represents 100% of the cost of the of your insurance of insuring you, adding her to the policy, then there's no additional taxes to you. But if the state is paying for that, because again you're not married and you're not a dependent, then it could be taxable if they're providing that for you. It's a taxable benefit instead of a non-taxable.
Her W-2 is increased, and I don't know the exact figures.
Yeah.
There is an increase above what her.
Yeah.
Her
so they're taking care of that, and so it is being taxed. So,
but there would be no opportunity for me for a deduction, even though she is contributing a substantial amount, and I don't know the exact figure, but it's, you know, $100 or $200 a month. You know, so, somewhere it's an, yeah, substantial amount.
No.
No. And she's paying it, so it's not even your expense.
Yeah. So
I mean, we share expenses with everything else. So.
Right. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well.
Oh well. It's a It's you're in the same boat as Judith Sears Poisson, who's to be perfectly honest. She's agreeing with what Dale's got to say here. She's looked into this many a time. thanks, Scott, for calling. Appreciate it. Jack, well, let's see. Before we go back to the phones, an email a long time back I want to get to. When you sell stock, you need to know the value of it when you received or bought it. That can be tricky when companies have gone through mergers and stock splits and what have you. What resources are available to help you figure that out?
If you hold individual stocks and not through a broker, the first place you ask is the broker that handles your stock. But you can go online and go to some of the financial sites and essentially Google the stock, and you can get the history of what it was selling for on the day that you bought it, when it split, what the what happened with the stock. It's tedious, but it's way easier than it was before we could Google.
Way easier. Jack in Menominee, Michigan. Hello.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I I live in Michigan. Both my wife and I have income in Michigan and Wisconsin through numerous part-time jobs. Most of our employers in Wisconsin have a Michigan tax ID number on the W-2, so I shouldn't have to file a separate Wisconsin return, but I have, or my wife has one employer that does not have a Michigan tax ID. So it comes up that I need to file a Wisconsin income tax return. Do I count for my state of Wisconsin income just the income from that one employer or from all the employers in the state, even though they've got the Michigan employer ID?
So you live in Michigan?
Yeah.
So there is a reciprocity agreement between Wisconsin and Michigan so that you can so the question is, was this employer withholding Wisconsin taxes for you, in which case you would have to file in Wisconsin to get a refund of those taxes.
Mm-hmm.
But then you would, don't you, you can let Michigan know somehow, don't you?
Well, you have to report all your income in your home state, and then you're a resident of Michigan, and so your earnings are all subject to Michigan taxes, and then depending on the agreements they have with other states, you don't have to pay taxes on the same income twice. You don't have to pay state taxes on the same income to Michigan and Wisconsin.
You just have to show them you paid to Wisconsin.
Yeah, the W-2 would be the... you would
show
have that,
that
information.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have refund coming to you, the only way you can get that from Wisconsin is to file
here.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But when I file my Wisconsin income tax, I've just got one out of three Wisconsin W-2s that doesn't state that it is withholding Michigan tax. It doesn't have the Michigan employer tax ID, just that one that has the Wisconsin tax ID number. Do I report for my Wisconsin income tax only that one that has the Wisconsin tax ID number, or do I have to lump in the other two W-2s, even though they have the Michigan tax ID number on those W-2s?
No, you just have to report as a non-resident.
The one
that you're trying to get the taxes applied to the right place.
Yep.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, Jack.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. I wonder if Ron in Newburgh is ready. Hi, Ron.
You bet I am. with the purchase price of your stock was always hard to find. So now they came up with a new 1099-B where it shows both the purchase price and the stock, even if it was purchased a long time back.
Mm-hmm.
But only one of these are shown as a box A.
Mm-hmm.
The rest are all shown as box B, where they say that the sales price was not furnished, or the purchase price was not furnished to the feds. So if this, all this paperwork was to show both the purchase and the sale, it's not being passed on to the feds except for one stock. And the other part of it, the form that I got from Schwab, the 1099-B with these 12 stocks on it where they don't show the price to the feds, that's a real hard to read form. Can I just attach that to my tax form and say, you guys have fun with it?
Do you file electronically or?
No. Okay. I generate my own paper copy and then I mail it in.
Yes, you can attach that, but you still have to put the total in the Schedule D and on the forms, the new forms that are for the box A and the box B, but then you can attach that. And so there was a new rule that the brokered houses had to provide basis information, and they so what they submit to the IRS is when they know what the basis information is for sure. They maybe handled it from the beginning, and the basis that is listed as not being submitted to the IRS, they are submitting the sale price to the IRS, but they are not submitting the basis information because they may have received that information from you, or they may have, you know, not handled it from the beginning, and that's their best information on what the basis is, which may or may not be correct. So it sends you back to figuring out what your purchase price was and what the stock splits were and all of that.
But the 1099-B for the 12 stocks actually has on it a purchase price.
Yes, it does. And what's submitted to the IRS electronically, which is how those are done, are the sales prices and just the purchase prices of those that are marked A. So even though you have a paper copy that has it on it, it's the preparer's best guess as to what the basis is, and they don't send that electronically to the IRS. When we prepare returns and we submit it electronically, we submit a copy of that paper along with our returns. So otherwise the IRS didn't have that information about that basis. And if we have other information that the basis was different, for example, if the stock was received from somebody after death where the price is stepped up and it may not be in there, then we override that information.
Well, there you go. Good luck, Ron. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Larry and Stevens Point, it's your turn. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I don't know whether you can help me with this one. H&R Block Tax Cut ran into a brick wall. We're not farmers, number one. We put some acreage at our home into the Conservation Reserve Program this last year, and as a result, we get some cost share for the cost of planting the prairie that we planted, plus we get an annual rent. I got a 1099-G with the cost share number and with the rent number. Now, the cost share is just a cost share. Is that taxable?
Yes.
And what form do I use?
That's miscellaneous income that you can include on line 21 of the form if you don't have a farm form to put it on, farm form. If it's the same land that you are renting, it's you could put it on that schedule. It's not that cost share is not subject to self-employment taxes, so you can, if that's the only extra income item, you can simply report it on line 21 as other income.
Well, is the cost share taxable since the money that we spent to put this in was after-tax dollars?
Yes, because and that 1099-G is an indication that it's been reported to the federal government, and they are looking on your return for you to have reported that.
Now, if you spent a bunch of money to get the land in shape, could you count that as an expense somewhere?
You could. I don't know the specifics, but
So what schedule?
Is it the land that you're renting that you did this improvement to?
No, it's our own land.
No.
Oh.
No.
But it's rented to the government in this program.
Okay. So you do need to report that income. the cost share.
Okay. I'll work it out with expenses because I don't feel like I should have to pay on that.
Well, they're reimbursing you for for what you spent, and so it's think of it as a windfall, you know, that you need to report as revenue.
Huh. All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Larry. Appreciate the call. Saeed in Fond du Lac. Hello.
I'm here.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Can you hear me properly?
Yes.
Okay, I have a question. In July of 2012, I bought out a gas station, and it was an S corporation before.
Okay, an S corp.
Not only I bought out the gas station, the company, but also the assets of the company. So it was both share purchases and also the purchase of the company's assets.
Okay.
So I became the 100% owner of the new corporation in July. And my question is, do I need to prepare two tax returns? And the corporation is going to issue two K-1s or just one?
Well, there was a change in ownership.
Right.
Basically, there was another owner, and you'd have to essentially close the books at the time that was sold, and the revenues and expenses for that period could go to the previous shareholder, and indicating that it's his final K-1. And then you have to report your share from the period of July to the end of the year. You can elect to do it to take an annual amount, but and report that to the former owner, you know, half of it if that works out more advantageously.
But I was told in S corporation you cannot have special allocations, so it has to go by the ownership percentage. So it should go up to July to him 100%.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. But my problem is how many tax returns or 1120S I have to file now, because with one 1120S I can issue one K-1, and at one time there were two owners. It was, he was 100% owner up to July, and then I became 100% owner from July onwards.
Well, if he was 100% before and you're the 100% now,
then you can report the 100% to yourself if you bought all the shares. If you bought 100% of the shares, then you're the shareholder of record at the end of the year.
And with that, we're out of time. Oh. Dale, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You'll come back and be with us again, I hope.
I'm actually scheduled to come back one more time this tax season.
All right. Dale Kunin of Wegner CPAs in Madison. She does a great job, our guest. She'll be back. And thank you for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.